Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tracy May, CEO of the Diversitas Group, and today we're talking about perfectionism and burnout, the critical link. According to a recent Deloitte survey, 87% of professionals say that they have a passion for their current job, yet 77% of these same employees also say that they have experienced burnout in the same job and frequently feel really stressed out. Since COVID-19, the lines between work and home have blurred in new and unusual ways, and many employees who are working remotely for the first time are struggling to preserve healthy boundaries between their professional and their personal lives. So today we're speaking with Alex Regal, a senior L&D advisor based here in Dubai, who experienced burnout for himself. In part one of this interview, I asked Alex to share more about his road to burnout and how perfectionism played a part in this. So I'm really pleased to have with me today Alex Regal, who is an HR professional with a background in professional services. And Alex is with me today to talk about the subject of burnout and more specifically his own personal experience with burnout. So thank you, Alex. It's wonderful to have you here. And I'm excited to launch into this topic with you to find out really more about your own personal experience. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the road to burnout that you've been on. What were the main features of that?
I had experience with burnout roughly 15 months ago. And to begin with the road, I will actually start with the actual burnout. We'll see that it was a big milestone in the road, but it started much earlier. So towards the end of February 2019, I had an episode in the office where I just broke down emotionally and to an extent physically as well, which was also a very strong moment of incomprehension for me. I just had no idea what was happening. All I knew was that it was the end of the road. Very overwhelming feelings and emotions, absolutely untethered in all directions. Though I've identified the first step towards, let's say, the final sprint towards burnout to be roughly 6 months before that.
Okay.
Before that even, I would say I've come closer to burnout over the last maybe 4 or 5 years, and things were very cyclical. I would feel better and then worse, just as long as I had an option to let go of pressure, get distracted, be it on vacation or be it doing sports, be it socializing, etc. I never got to, say, the final nail in the coffin and breaking down. But in the last 6 months I was in the office, pressure just kept piling up and up. And I couldn't find any ways to exteriorize it anymore. So it just compounded until the day it was the end of the road.
So it's almost like burnout was the sort of end point of quite a long journey, and it sounds like you were heading in the direction for some time, but managing sometimes to distract yourself from it and then not being successful in doing that towards the end.
Exactly. More than an end point, I would say a highlight, because burnout was not the end of the journey. A lot has happened since then. Some of it very challenging and difficult to overcome. Some of it has been the road to recovery, which is still ongoing today. But yes, it was just a progressive deterioration of my mental state, with less and less empathy as I was going towards burnout, more and more irritability, if you say that in English, obviously. A lot more anger, a lot more pressure in general. What I've noticed afterwards was that it was the product of two phenomena that were happening in the same time. The first one was that I had an increase in the pressure I was experiencing at work and a decrease in the ways I usually had to manage the stress. Right? To give you a few examples, I quit smoking, which objectively was very good for my health. I quit smoking roughly 3 months before I burnt out. However, afterwards, I realized I had just deprived myself of a crutch to lean on. Right? Something else that might seem trivial is that the office I used to work in moved, and from being 25 minutes away by car in the morning and in the evening, I was 3 minutes away. So I thought, oh, that's also very positive. I can sleep a bit more in the morning and just have a very short commute, maybe even walk in the winter, which I never got to do effectively. But it just deprived me of a space to zone into work and zone out of work. I could not see the sun as much as I used to anymore. I couldn't make a call to my friends or my sister in the morning. I couldn't listen to music. And driving is a very happy thing for me, and I was deprived of that. So I was literally falling from my bed into my chair, from my chair into my bed.
So it's really interesting for me to hear you say that, because I think about the current situation with COVID and the initial response of many people when they were sort of locked down and they thought, wow, fantastic, I can work from home now. And the reality of actually now we don't have those segues between one activity and another. And some people are finding themselves chained to their desk for 14 hours a day. You know, just in terms of your own experience, I'm hearing you highlight those little moments, a call with your sister, a walk in the walk to work, some time in the sun. As you reflect back, you know, how important are those self-care moments, those little self-care moments in our well-being?
They are capital, though they are not necessarily the key. There are ways we have to protect ourselves, maintain a healthy state of mind. But if we evolve in a toxic environment, or let's say at least a challenging environment, we're going to need more and more of those little things. So if we can enjoy those little moments, if I think about going for a cigarette during the day, you know, despite the backlash smokers receive in the office because we take breaks, others don't. We have a small social moment where we don't think about work, we talk about something else, we are outside. At the same time, we use those to manage stress that we have already. And unfortunately, a lot of this stress could be avoided. So the higher the aggression, I would say, the higher the coping mechanisms need to be. And there's probably a joint responsibility in there.
So tell me a little bit more about that, because you know, you spoke about your pressure increasing and increasing towards the end, just before you sort of hit the wall. And I'm curious, you know, where is that pressure? Where was that pressure coming from?
From me, very strongly reinforced by my surroundings, my peers, my hierarchy, because it was the environment I was evolving in. However, I found out very recently that I was a perfectionist. I am now a recovering perfectionist. What was very surprising was that I never thought of myself as being good enough to be considered a perfectionist, which in itself is probably the definition, right? A very strong trait of perfectionists.
A bit of a clue.
Exactly. Now, I need to go back to my childhood for that, right? My parents raised me and my sister to always do well whatever it is that we were doing. We used to play the music and we were pushed to the limit. We used to do sports, we were pushed to the limit. In our social interactions, we were pushed. I'm not going to say the limit, but the highest standard we could accomplish. Right? Eventually, I became a young adult and I internalized this education, and I needed no figure of authority to just keep me under pressure. Now, this is what happened in my professional experience. I was constantly keeping myself under pressure, and I had, from my hierarchy, from my peers, just this sort of momentum that everybody was going towards. Now, not everybody breaks down in environments like these, but if I go back to my example of the office having moved, some people had a longer drive. So maybe for them, it was a better way to cope. Now, one thing that added a lot of pressure to me was that I had just been promoted.
Right.
And I worked hard to get this promotion. So in my head, the contract was, prove that you can get promoted, you will get promoted, which I did. But the moment I got promoted, the message was not, well done. The message was, pressure is on. So I thought...
So more performance pressure.
Exactly. Where does it end? What's extremely important is that I do not think a contract was put on my head. I was unable to manage the perception of added pressure because in reality, the feedback I was receiving was not catastrophic. You know, I evolved in a culture where we look for the highest possible standards, which comes at a price. However, I was able to manage that stress for a few years. Now, being out of my comfort zone and feeling I needed to prove myself at a higher level added that pressure.
So is there something about, just hearing you talk, I'm thinking about imposter syndrome and pressure coupled with perfectionism that performs a bit of it becomes a perfect storm, doesn't it?
It is, absolutely. It's an extremely vicious cycle. Imposter syndrome is absolutely correct. I have definitely experienced imposter syndrome. I have also experienced, maybe it's not the actual term, but something that would get very close to it was Stockholm syndrome. So I was stuck in a place where I was feeling endangered and illegitimate. And at the same time, I was not able to leave this place because I felt I would not be, to take a shortcut, loved anywhere else, appreciated anywhere else. And I felt redeemable to my employer for allowing me really to work here because no one else would want anything to do
so
with
this me. Idea that you're lucky to
Absolutely.
Be here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking about, you know, people right now, so many people and sitting with a lot of job insecurity, also perhaps taking on other people's workloads as companies cut down and, you know, economize, and how much that plays into that same mindset. I'm lucky to be here and I really have to prove myself or else I'm going to lose my job.
Yeah. The main challenge, for having had quite a few conversations with some of my friends who are working in lockdown conditions, even the ones who were managing to approach the situation as it's a contract, I am doing a job for which I'm being paid, being very detached, you know, 8 to 5, 9 to 6, are now being challenged because the boundary between home and work has been completely removed. And they need to provide an extra effort to maintain this boundary. For a while, being in lockdown meant we could not even go outside for a walk, right? To sort of, once again, zone in, zone out. So that has put a lot of strain on people who were working. I've heard quite a few testimonies of those very people who felt under intense scrutiny, hence had to work longer hours just to prove that they were just online.
Ironically, even though we're not in eyesight of each other, the pressure to perform,
the pressure
the sun has actually
higher.
Gone up. You know what really interests me, Alex, is hearing your story and hearing your sort of long journey into this moment of burnout. And I guess other people listening to this right now might be holding questions about, you know, where am I? Am I on the way to burnout? And I, you know, as an executive coach, I talk to people all the time, and I know that this is something that is of concern to a lot of people. How aware were you in that slow build-up to that final moment of breakdown? How aware were you that this was happening?
A very round 0%. I've had a lot of experience with burnout. My mother burnt out extremely severely around 2008, and she started getting her head above the water in 2017. I was very educated on the topic of burnout, which was very new to me when it just begun, but I was very aware of what a burnout would be, what would lead to burnout. However, I was under the false impression that burnout was the condition. It isn't. Burnout is an alarm. It's a signal your body and your mind give you just to tell you this is enough. And then we have a choice to make. Right? That was my first mistake. The second one was a lack of exposure to different situations, different triggers that would lead someone to burn out. So I was under the impression that I was protecting myself, but protecting myself from aggravating factors that were not mine for a condition that I had wrongly defined. So I did not see anything come my way because those signs were there. I was just completely unable to see them.
So on the one hand, you had a mental concept about what burnout looks like and you'd observed it in somebody else. And another level, you didn't recognize your own triggers and your own context and how that was contributing to the same impacts on you.
It was part of the journey. I think I saw a glimpse of it once or twice, which was immediately extinguished because I never felt legitimate to raise my hand and say, I don't know what's going on and I need help, which for a perfectionist is the confession that we are not good enough to do something so unthinkable, right?
It sounds like quite an isolating experience.
Extremely isolating. Especially because I was seeing some of my friends, peers, colleagues trying to help me.
Right. So they were seeing the signs before you were seeing
them. Some people saw them. Within those people, some didn't say anything because they didn't think there was a platform to do so, which is unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Some people tried. And I actually pushed them away, acknowledging, literally, I know what you're doing, I see you and I appreciate it, but it's too late for me. So I felt on this dinghy on a river, immutably pushed towards the final waterfall without any option to reach the bank and just, you know, press the pause button and say, you know what, this is not good.
So in those moments where other people were reaching out to help you and you had the sense that this is too late, what was your thinking there? Because I know that sometimes we look at a behavior and it makes no sense, but behavior always makes sense. So how did you kind of process your response in that way to say it's too late?
The thing is, around that time, so this very example happened maybe 2 or 3 weeks before I actually broke down, but the last 2 months before the event were unbearable. I was under constant pressure, and the more it went, the more I was describing to some of those people that I felt an impending doom, and I actually used the word. Just saying something big is coming. It will hit very hard. I don't know what it is. I don't know when it will hit, but the sense of fate nearly, right? And the moment I started having that feeling, whoever would say whatever, I was convinced something was going to happen.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, in reality, as I learned afterwards, that was the very incubation of anxiety syndrome, which I've been diagnosed with afterwards. But yeah, this feeling of there's nothing I can do about it and there's nothing anyone can do about it. Objectively, I could have asked for a long-term leave of absence. I could have resigned. I couldn't. We live in Dubai. I need money to live. I need a job to have a visa. So how can I get myself out of the fire without jumping into another one? So I was scared, and my mind was just so busy that I could not even stop and think, what else could I do? Right? Going back to my parents' place would have been a failure for me. I did not want to do that. I'm very happy being an expat. I could not see myself doing what would have felt like a few steps back. That was unthinkable.
So that lack of options and community support, or the perceived lack for expats, for people whose job is connected to their visa, that brings a very high level of stress. You mentioned, you know, jumping out of one fire into another fire. It sounds like that perceived lack of options is what really kept you on a track, even though you knew the track was heading to disaster.
It is, you know, we've all been uprooted here, for some of us several times, from continent to continent. The reality is that the situation in the UAE is that there is very little safety net. Right? We choose to be here and we're extremely happy being here. The lifestyle, honestly, is quite enjoyable. But yeah, there is very little safety net. And for all of us, or let's say most of us, our lives are connected to an employer, right? There are actually other options to remain legally in the country or just to choose to go somewhere else. I just shut off those options because I didn't even know they existed.
Mm.
For me, going somewhere else was not an option because I wanted to stay here. Finding another way to remain legally in the country felt like creating too many problems, maybe even playing with the law, which I don't want to do. So I felt stuck in a situation that I knew was extremely damageable to me, but I couldn't get out of. The worst in all that was that I ended up convincing myself that this was the best I could get. From a situation perspective, be it immigration, financial, etc., but also from a professional standpoint, I had become convinced that no one would ever want to hire me. And I was actually thankful to this company, intrinsically thankful,
so it's like
for allowing me to work here.
Yeah, so it's a bit like better the devil you know, stay with what you have.
Absolutely.
That. Yeah. So really appreciate you sharing this. And I'm just, you know, as we come to the end of this segment, really want to leave the listener with some advice or something useful. In the next segment, we'll talk about recovery. But in terms of the journey into burnout, looking at it from this side of the experience, what would you say to somebody who is sensing that they're on a similar kind of path?
The first thing I would say is get your foot off the pedal. Right? You need to raise your hand. You need to ask for help. And if you feel you're not being heard, which was unfortunately my case, I tried metaphorically knocking on a couple doors which were slammed in my face. And that discouraged me. However, eventually I found someone to talk to, which was post-burnout, but I tried. Speak up, because if you think you are on the path to burnout, you definitely are, right? I was convinced I wasn't, and I was.
Mm-hmm.
So ask for help. Be aware of the things that change in your life. Things change all the time, but some signs for me were extremely clear. For the last few weeks before I burnt out, I was not able to dress up in the morning. Right? I could not wear leather shoes. I could not wear button-up shirts. And the more it went, the more I was going to the office in trainers with a polo, which is against the dress code policy that we have. So I was once again between a rock and a hard place. What can I do to be comfortable without putting myself into trouble from a policy point of view?
So even on a physical level, your body Absolutely. Was telling you, I can't do this anymore. We need to do something differently.
Absolutely. I was not able to use my mind to feel better. I was physically unable to touch my shoes. I could not even I would look at them and quickly look away just in case they would jump at me. Right? My professional phone, right after I burnt out, was on a shelf, and I let the battery drain. 2 weeks later, I bumped into it, basically. My eyes laid upon the phone, knowing full well the battery was drained, and I was terrorized that the screen would turn on because somebody was calling.
So everything associated with your professional life, you began to want to withdraw from. It was just like absolutely your body was saying it's enough.
Probably even a level higher. Anything associated with judgment of my intrinsic value. Because all the sports I was doing, the photography I was doing, the vacation planning I was doing brought me no joy anymore, and I was only seeking performance. And I did not even realize that I was doing things automatically without any form of pleasure, which was another sign, right? Socializing, doing sports, I'm growing into photography. I was just putting myself under even more and more pressure, which was a clear sign. The things I knew I would enjoy, I would do mechanically, feeling empty, because there was no way I would gain any pleasure from it, which was objectively another sign.
Yeah, so it's interesting in terms of recognizing the signs you spoke about, you know, talk to somebody, raise your hand. It sounds like it's also important to notice your emotional mood shift and what gives you pleasure and what doesn't give you pleasure. which sometimes we argue with, you know, it's not rational. So we go, well, that's silly. It's a pair of shoes, or that's silly. It's a phone. But in terms of your own relationship to that object or to what it symbolizes, that's what we have to start to notice.
Within reason, we need to remove judgment from this kind of situation.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, my own judgment is what's prevented me from pushing even further in my research for help. Right? I had no connection with my own value as a person. So I could only go with what the external world would bring back to me.
Yeah.
When I first said something is wrong, I don't feel right, I need help, and I was told, get a grip. I thought, well, then you are illegitimate in what you're feeling. So you try to repress that. And the more it goes, the more you try to repress until eventually the pressure cooker just blows up.
Mm.
In hindsight, I was extremely lucky, because otherwise I would have probably gone even further and further into the belly of the beast.
For part two of this interview, which will be released on our website, www.thediversitasgroup.com. If you'd like to learn more about how we can support you to understand your diversity dynamics and foster inclusive leadership behaviors in your organization, please get in touch. We look forward to hearing from you.